This is Snakes and Otters, a pointless discussion of eternal questions. Get ready. We're about to live in your head rent-free.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. And guess what this episode is? It's a...
Hoopajube!
There we go. On this Hoopajube, we're going to get back to the writing side of things that a lot of us dabble in here.
And I'm sorry, Cajun. I was stomping on you there.
Oh, okay. Stomp away.
I am Martin.
And I'm Robert.
And I'm Francis.
I'm Marcus.
And I'm Andre.
And I'm Cajun, and we're all here at the ranch again.
Yes, we are.
Love it. Mm-hmm.
Just had a fine meal prepared by Cajun.
Fine.
Oh,
yes.
Fine.
We greatly, greatly appreciate your hospitality and generosity, sir.
Yes.
He puts Martin Stewart to shame. I'm going with the male version.
At least he didn't say Martha this time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, puts her to shame, too.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Short ribs is very good. It's very good.
Oh, yes, man. We had short ribs. I also did some pulled beef, my homemade sauces, barbecue.
Barbecue was excellent.
Alabama white.
Had some of that on the taters, too. Mm-hmm.
And some big taters.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. It was a man's meal today.
It was.
That's right. Manly men doing manly things. That's what we're all about here.
Meat and taters.
That's right.
Meat and taters, yep.
My God.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about a seminar that I went to recently in Colorado Springs in the month of February there, and we'll give some updates on how personal writing projects have been going and anything else to take note of in the writing industry today that we want to cover. So,
now, what was the name of this one?
This was a Superstars writing seminar,
right,
and it was started about 10 years ago by Kevin J. Anderson.
Yeah.
And if you're thinking, that name sounds familiar. Well, even if you've never read any of his works, you should recognize it from the new Dune release.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Kevin
J.
Anderson and Herbert Sun wrote the last two movies here that's been coming out together.
Yeah, they did, of course, several of the follow-on novels. And you know,
quite a few.
I liked some of them, but I thought some of them were just not. It didn't seem to fit with the mythology that Frank Herbert had kind of laid out to me. But
well, now that's an interesting note you bring that up. When I was listening to one of Kevin's talks there, he said that as they got into it, they were trying to decide exactly what direction it needed to go in. Because Frank's son, he wasn't really keen on getting into it at first. Till Kevin and him sat down to talk, and his son was cleaning out the garage.
Oh, wow.
And there was a box up in the rafters that had been up there for years. They had got it down, and it was notebook upon notebook of Frank's notes.
That's the basis of what they work with?
And they used a lot of that to get that, which gave them direction on where they headed.
So some of the good stuff may have been Herbert. Some of it may not have been Herbert.
Maybe. It's hard to say without seeing the original material. And of course, to be fair, the writing styles are very different as well. And that also will color the experience of the books.
Oh, yes.
So,
oh, yes.
You know, there's some of that. I enjoyed reading them. I just, they weren't necessarily what I thought of as the past of Dune, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But anyways, we're getting far afield. Kevin J. Anderson is a great writer.
He's done so many things connected with the Star Wars universe over the years and many other franchises out there. You got to stop and think. Kevin J., besides the older ones going back to Heinlein and Asimov and so forth, he is one of the original OGs of the modern world that we grew up with from our youth.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin J., his wife, Rebecca Moesta, Wesley Dean Smythe, I forget exactly how he pronounces that one.
Smythe, yeah. Uh-huh.
Smith. It might be Smith, I think. Who was another one?
You're talking Anne McCaffrey and things like
Anne McCaffrey's in that group. Of course, her son's at a lot of these events, and he continued on with a lot
Here's
of
Anthony.
Stuff.
Here's Anthony, yeah. Well, Mercedes Lackey, she's still running around. And
a lot of these people ran together back in New York City and some of the bigger places together, and they came up together.
C.J. Cherry.
Jim Butcher.
Jim Butcher.
Alan Dean Foster.
Alan Dean Foster. Yeah, he did
one.
a lot of Star Trek.
They all know each other.
As a matter of fact, Foster did Star Wars novels before Kevin J. did them.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And he did the adaptations of the animated series in the Star Trek universe back in the 70s.
Yeah.
That plus he also did, if I remember right, the actual screenplay for Star Trek: The Motion Picture.
Oh.
Oh, and Timothy Thawne was up. Zahn was up in Indianapolis at that show.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
I wish he'd been able to make it up that way because his trilogy of Thrawn.
Yeah, that was
one of the best ever written.
Yeah. I believe that was the first licensed extended universe novels back in the, late 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah it was. But Superstores, yeah, I know I've talked about 20 books to 50K conference in
Las Vegas,
yeah, every year in November. And Superstores reminds me more of that when it first started out before they got so big. Superstores caps their attendance at like 400. So it doesn't go really extreme. Mm-hmm. They have it in Colorado Springs. Nice area, a lot of nice restaurants, but it's not all the glitz and glamour and neon and shows of Vegas.
Right.
So you don't get distracted. You go there to learn, to work, and so forth. That's the way 20 Books started out when I first went. I think there was about 350 people at the first one I went to, and that was actually the second one they did. So I was really enjoyed getting back to Superstores and that more smaller size.
See, that sounds very appealing to me because that's what I love about Imaginarium here in town.
Yes.
Is that it's small and they put on so many different seminars and workshops. You can't go to all the ones you want to go to.
No, yeah, not at all.
The content
and that's coming
primo.
Up this July that's for anybody right. out there that's in the area and stuff yep. that might want to
July 19th, 20th, and 21st, I believe.
That's right.
It's definitely worth going to also.
Yep.
Superstores, it's a little pricier the first time you go, but once you go, you're considered an alumni. He's basically treating it as a school. In fact, Kevin J. Anderson has a master's program through Western University on publication.
Oh, wow.
Excellent.
That he's been teaching for several years now. So he treats it very seriously as a learning experience. So once you go the first time, then it's like $400 cheaper after that. Because you're considered an alumni.
That's some significant jack.
Right. This is, yeah, it is not for the faint of heart. You know, we go to Imaginarium, it's $150. Mm-hmm. Less if you get it early, but.
This was closer to like $800 or so the first time out.
For 4 days, am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is normally that's what most of these things run is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Yeah.
Which, if you break it down on 4 days, it seems more reasonable to the mind, even though it is a bit of a lump to put out
right,
to begin
right.
with.
Yeah, it's $100 a day, which is about
minimum.
Which is about what you're looking at. Yeah,
but from everything you've talked about and from what I've read on the website, it is well worth it if you can cough up the dough and have the time to take from work.
And the people that Kevin Jay, like I say, knows been in the business so long. He had Jim Butcher there this year.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
One of your favorite writers I saw again, mm-hmm. and that would be
David Weber.
David Weber. Yep. Which he's always scheduled to be back next year. I do know that off the top of my head. I saw that announcement the other day.
He gives a great talk. I've seen some of his online talks.
He did, and he went to one talk that I went to that he filled in for somebody else at the last minute that couldn't make it due to weather issues or so forth, and it was on preparation from the business side, like what taxes yes. and so forth.
Yeah, you and I've had conversations
up,
about that.
I was talking to Francis here that he recommended setting up an S-corp.
Yes.
Because with an S-corp, your writing can never be classified by the IRS as a hobby if it doesn't make profit. A lot of things, if you're doing it as a hobby and taking off your taxes after 4 or 5 years at the most, if they don't see a profit and you're paying taxes, they will classify it as a hobby and you will no longer be able to take it off on your taxes. But if you set it up as an S-corp, they cannot do that.
Wise words. Wise words.
It costs a little jack to set it up that way, but
even that
itself, good advice.
That itself would be taken out.
Because on the average, you take a writer is not going to make money for a number of years till he has a backlog or catalog.
Yep. Catalog is so important, especially if you're doing it independently. Because you need to have multiple titles for sale for Amazon's own algorithms to really start taking you seriously, unless you manage your first launch right, and you manage to strike gold.
And and that's there are very few out there like Terry Brooks. We were at the same panel at Imaginarium, and he was on there. Of course, he's written gazillion, he's a legend. And they were talking about how did you get in the business. He said, "Well, my first book sold a million copies, so I guess I was lucky."
They asked you what do you recommend doing to be successful? And he's like, "Well, I really don't know because
first book sold a million copies."
So my recommendation is sell a million copies.
That's right.
Yeah, just go do that.
Everybody laughed, but he's right. I mean, and that goes back to what I hear a lot of when we talk, because in the writer's universe, there's always people talking, how'd you do it? How do you want to do it? How can you do it? And luck cannot be minimized. It cannot be minimized. There is a certain amount of that that is just kind of the thing, being in the right place at the right time, talking to the right people at the right time. I think it is a people business. I really do. the more I do it. You got to have a certain degree of talent, but that can be honed, that can be crafted, that can be gotten there.
Well,
that takes time.
And honestly, judging by some of the books I've seen that have been published traditionally, even.
Yeah.
I don't mean even the independent one, the people who do it themselves.
Yeah.
But judging by some of those traditionally published books that I've read, even talent is a lot lower level than you think.
Oh yeah, it is because there's some amount of you. How did this get? You know, because I'm a big forensic editor most of the time. It's harder to do on your own work, but I mean, I spot a typo from 1,000 yards. And what? You know, or people that that professionally are doing sort of things, and they'll send out emails of the worst. But you know, you can go on any website you want, news website. And how did this pass muster? Answer: nobody edits. Mm-hmm. They want to get it out immediately.
Well, and even in the most highly edited book from a traditional publisher, something's going to slip through.
And I get that, but I think you're right. This bucks the percentages.
Yeah. Well, it's not even just the typos. I mean, just the quality of the writing itself. Mm-hmm. You know, whether
Martin is about to pee his pants over here.
No. I don't have a ton to contribute to this because I don't have the experience that you guys have. But oddly enough, I stumbled across a couple of articles about authors this week. Perhaps...
How fortuitous.
Yeah, perhaps something is listening. I don't know. But I read a lengthy article on Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, yes. An amazing author.
Right.
Somewhat controversial only because he's so in your face and so dark.
Yeah, the hyper-violent.
Hyper-violent. That's hyper-violent. Exactly it.
But, you know, and it talked about the span of his career was so unusual. He began writing, I think it's like in the early 60s.
Yeah.
And after he finished his first novel, he really had no idea what to do. So he just... The only publishing house he knew about was Random House. He just mailed it in. And it just, I forget what they call the pile, but it...
Slush pile.
Slush pile. It just went on the slush pile until an editor came across it.
Just so happened, yeah.
Just, you know, and that editor thought it was awesome.
Yeah, saw something in that.
You know, and so he got published. But he sold like 2,500 copies.
That's a success.
That's a high success on that. Yeah. And
but not for Random House.
Well, no. But
I mean, it was a money loser.
Yeah, it is. But I've been hearing a lot lately about the gatekeeping that is going on at the big publishers.
Yes.
And I'm glad you kind of talked to that.
And so his career spans this change of all of these independent publishers then going away.
Yep.
Yes.
They're all being, you know, merged and bought and consumed. And what then became important was you couldn't just be this boutique publisher where you had 10 misses and one hit. The people who took over these conglomerations said, no, every book's got to make a profit, and you better figure it out.
Yeah.
And so as he got in along the line there, he eventually left Random House, the editor who had kind of sustained him. Died, and in 79 he hired an agent, and that agent then engineered a move to another publisher, who then promoted him, and then suddenly a few years later he's a success. But he went through many, many years of getting by on like grants, like he was, you know, like a MacArthur Genius Grant or something. That's what allowed him to like eat,
yeah,
you know. But and he had nothing for a long, long time, and then suddenly he started having some success, and eventually, like No Country for Old Men, and
it's
another book,
became
movies, and then suddenly he's a huge success. So it was this; he benefited from both publishing models in odd ways.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's because of his time.
He stayed in the
business. Yeah.
You know, somebody kept him in the business and kept him writing, even though he wasn't a commercial success.
Yeah.
And then when the model changed, then he became a commercial success.
And
people pushed
huge.
You know, they promoted him because of the quality.
And promotion is big in the industry. And like you, I'm not a producer of literature. I'm a consumer of it. But the name that comes to mind is Stephen King.
Of course,
his writing is consumed widely, and from a technical point of view, I would say it's not really that great of writing.
Oh, I disagree.
I think the stories are wonderful, but
if you read Stephen King from the beginning,
I read everything he's written
to today, I think his writing is just orders of magnitude better. Now, the one thing I will disagree on as far as quality is that nobody edits. So, I mean, he talks about how he will, you know, he'll write and he pantses, you know, he's a pantser, and then he immediately cuts 10%. He needs to cut about at least a quarter. Because there's a lot of stuff he leaves in that other writers are not allowed to.
But my point being is that the name Stephen King, he could publish takeout menus
and
he's
going to
sell 10 million copies.
What the reason why, though, is he's consistently good.
Well, yeah, he had to get to that point. I mean, because you had to have, you know, the 70s and 80s and 90s, he's putting out stuff to the point. And of course, once you make it into the movies, you're a name. But, you know, he never dropped off in quality, or I don't want to say quality. I want to say ideas.
Oh, he
ideas.
Got a little quality for a few years there where he had a few difficulties.
Well, yeah, and that's when he was addicted, too.
Well, no, actually, some people think when he was on
Rick
drugs
too.
Is when he was the best.
Better, and there's there's some talk about that, yes.
Yeah, and I don't know that I necessarily agree, but, you know, the thing is, he worked.
Yeah. Oh, and still does.
And he still does, and he works every day. Except his birthday and Christmas, apparently, and I'm sure a few other days. You know, you got to go to the doctor, whatever. That's understood. But if it's available as a work day, he works it. And that's how he's honed his craft.
Yeah, and then become a billionaire. You know, and but rightfully so, earnedly so.
Genre kind of matters. Mm-hmm. He published in a genre that was more tailored for consumption. And say, like Cormac McCarthy.
Well, yeah, it's commercial fiction, which has changed
a
lot
since
that time.
You really got to want to take a bite of his stuff. Because, again, one of his early novels was like a serial pedophile killer, you know, story. And No Country for Old Men is you know, the hyper-violent, non-redemptive, you know, there's no hero's redemption in a lot of his stories.
Right, yeah, it's very mm-hmm. I don't want to say nihilistic, but it's certainly dark. Very, but you know, there's a
nihilistic's maybe not wrong.
And I'm.
He was not much of a talker. Like very famously, like his interview with Oprah was very flat, because he doesn't promote himself and he doesn't go on talks and didn't. I mean, he is dead now.
He definitely doesn't.
He doesn't do it now. because he passed away in 23. I think he was like 89 though.
Yeah, he's got quite a prolific streak, because he's been doing this since the 60s.
Yeah,
but only recently, relatively speaking, come into his own. But you know, he's also another example of kind of the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, so he didn't go out and do the talks and all that. You know, try to bring people in. He's just like, I'm just a writer. I'm not a celebrity.
Ah, but that's
I know
that's the disconnect.
Yeah. So, but he in some of the statements he did make, I found interesting that essentially this idea of, look, humans are scum, and this notion that we can be better and improve ourselves is so dangerous, and the people who buy into that are the first ones who would not only sacrifice their freedom, but take your freedom away from you in the name of this improvement of humanity. It's like, oh, that's a dark dude.
So, but you know, when you said that humans are scum, I thought does I think Martin has that tattooed on the small of his back, you know?
Well, I get it. Why would it be, you know?
No, on the inside of his eyelids.
Seared into my memory because it stood out, you know, that this writer, that's like, that's not a very writery sentiment, because usually it's about, you know, this hero that comes out better at the end after a trial.
Well, and
that's not what he did.
And it's very interesting you say that, because one of the things that we've come to in this change, and I think it's changing back, I think, but you still see it, especially in the gatekeepers, is there are certain formulas or general tracks that you have to have just to get looked at. By anything, your protagonist must have an arc. They must change in some fashion. It can be negative, but as a general, they don't like that. And there's certain expectations that you have to have. And the more you learn about it, they are, I don't want to say constricting, but they are multiple. They are legion.
Well, part of that's
conventional.
Yeah. Part of that, though, is just the genre. You know, one of the things that I think novices in the field glom onto is like, well, you know, tropes are bad. You know, I don't want to be somebody who's cliched. What they really mean is, I haven't studied my craft enough to know that what you're calling cliches and tropes are just the conventions of that particular genre.
That's correct.
It's how you use them and make them different for your specific story is important. But you cannot do a love story without certain tropes.
That's exactly right. And romance,
lovers have to argue a bit. They have to go head to head. They have to have their first kiss. There's all these different things.
Yeah. Romance is highly scripted.
Yes.
And you must conform to that frequency. And yet, it is the number one selling genre in
what's one of the most popular movie channels? Hallmark,
absolutely.
And yet it's the same damn story.
That's right. But there's a reason people want
kill
that.
Me now.
Yeah.
People but it want sells.
That. It sells, and that's and there's a reason for that, and it is somewhat restricting. But when you work your way through that, I think you're exactly right, Robert. The magic is in, and here's the talent. Hopefully, is doing it different and better and clearer and aha-ing than yeah. many
See,
of
that's
your
why I don't
competitor.
Like to call it restrictive because it's like a lot of us here are comic book fans. And I can't stand a writer or a creative team that will come in and basically crap all over everything that's gone before. We say, well, that's too constricting. I can't be creative. It's like, no, you don't want to tell a story that's a Superman story or a Captain America story. You want to tell your story and change the character to fit it because that's where you got hired to be. You have to tell a story that is consistent.
Right.
That makes you be creative. It doesn't restrict
you. It forces you actually to be a hell of a lot better.
All right. On that note, let's see what David Weber had to say about why characters matter.
Oh. Ah, excellent.
I think this falls right into there.
Good.
Now, he made six bullet points there, and of course, my note-taking is not per se quotes, but the first one to come up is character function. What is the function of this character?
Yeah.
That's what you were just hitting on. Don't try to make it something else. Mm-hmm. Let the character be itself, basically.
Yep.
And really, that gets to all of them. What are the pillars of that character? I mean, their faith, their honor, their commitments. What do they believe in? Stay true to them. What is the environment of the character? How does that change them, focus them? Mm-hmm. How did it develop them if you go back in earlier years? The internal geography of the character. So their thought process matters. How do they arrive at points? How do they arrive at conclusions? Is it logical? Is it emotional? What's the process? Access to the character. Well, you might ask, what does that mean?
Yeah,
what is access to the character? Can that character be accessed? Is people able to connect with them? And
right.
So
understand
how
them,
how
relate
them?
Other
how
characters in the book have access to that character and their development. It comes from both sides on that, not just one. It's what's internally happening in the book, too. And play fair with the character. That goes exactly back to your last point, trying to make their story fit your story. Play fair with the character. Let the character be themselves once you create them and let them develop. Because characters will develop on their own.
Oh, hell yes.
If you let them run, they will be writing a scene for you, and you're thinking, I didn't want that. And they're saying, shut up and let it ride.
Well, that is exactly where I'm at currently. I'm working on the third novel in my series, and I'm going through the synopsis phase, and I really wasn't sure exactly where I was going to go. And one of my characters has ended up writing the last four chapters in a way I had not planned because I know him well enough now that, of course, he's going to do it this way. It has to be this way.
Yeah.
And it's taking you into a place that it fits my general idea of where we're going, but I would have never dreamed that this was how this was going to work because I've built in the flaws. I've built in his approach. I've built in the way he looks at things, his weak spots. He's got to play the hero, especially when it comes to women. It's just a thing, and wow, it's I'm hoping, anyway, brought about some really good conflict and visceral moments, which in my genre, the espionage thriller, you got to have them. Going back to those tropes.
I tell you what, Weber is the he's one of the best at characters, in my opinion. Partially that's because he tends to write series, so he knows whereof he speaks.
Yes,
I could think of the Honor Harrington character, and come up with specific things for each one of those bullet points that you talked about. Especially
he
that last
examples
one.
Examples during his talk with all these, usually in the Honor universe, of course.
And, because that's a character that he had planned to kill off a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But the story didn't, he couldn't do it. Well, one, the fans would probably would have hunted him down and strung him up. But it just, it worked better. And then also by collaborating with other authors, it changed the direction where he was going.
Now that you mention that, that goes to his legacy talk. He mm-hmm. already has plans for when something happens where he can no longer write due to mental or physical health or something, or passes away. The Honor Harrington universe will continue out with the writers he's been co-writing with. He's groomed a couple people already to carry on the story, even after he's gone, in the fashion that he wants it to be.
Sure. Yes, unfortunately, one of his, actually, I think maybe more than one, but I think, because I think both David Drake and Eric Flint have passed. And they were two of his primary collaborators.
He outlived his successors.
Yes, but he's got a couple other he's been working with.
Yeah.
Too.
So, yeah. But especially Eric Flint is a great loss to the writing community. He's another one that's fantastic with characters. But anyways. So what did Superstars, because I know there's a lot of, you seem to talk about there's a lot of craft-related stuff and some of it the business side with what they talked about, but was there anything said about what we were talking about earlier with the gatekeepers and how all of that has changed and worked?
There are panels, of course, that discusses the major powers that be up in New York and so forth. And a lot of authors, those that started out as original authors in the old system, are no longer, there's very few that go by just the old system. More of them is a mix of self-publishing and publishing through houses and smaller publishers, and even starting up their own publishing houses, which a prime example is Kevin J. Anderson did that. He's got his own house going, and he brings a lot of novelists and stuff in, people he knows, people he doesn't know, people he mentors through his classes that he's teaching, the course there at Western University. They take and get submissions for short stories. The first time you go to Superstars, you're allowed to submit two short stories to his classes, and he uses those for examples, and the ones that make it get published, come out in a book.
Nice. Yeah, there you
nice.
Go.
So you got a couple nice incentives for that to work on that. And, you know, it's like he said, there's too many options to put all your eggs in one basket out that way.
Yep, absolutely.
So would you say that the gatekeeper system as we know it today is crumbling or even falling?
It has definitely changed and is morphing into something different than it has been before.
I think you're always going to have those gatekeepers.
Yeah, but they just won't have the power that they once had.
Are the gatekeepers, this is a point of inquiry, are the gatekeepers now human or are they turning more to AI to scan?
Ooh, he mentioned that nasty thing. He just called Satan into this group on writing.
That's right.
Beelzebub.
AI is not something that's well looked upon in a lot of circles these days.
Well, I think he's talking about for the evaluation.
No, an AI program is not to that effect that it can successfully pick and choose like that anymore yet.
And I think most gatekeepers would not want to cede that power.
Yeah, because because it's involved with power completely.
Yeah.
Basically, when we say gatekeepers, you're talking about the editors. Acquisition editors at the big five publishing, which is big three, big five, big four.
Well, and even at the smaller publishers, I mean, you know, there's always a gatekeeper if you're not a self-publish author.
Yeah, and some of them are very easy to work with.
Yes,
but at the big five, everybody wants in. And
that's where the biggest money,
where the money's at,
comes in.
So that's true. And I understand the bar is going to be higher, but. The problem with that is as Martin was saying earlier, they've decided every book must make must be profitable. Mm-hmm. So the structure is almost cookie cutter from one to the other.
Well,
genre.
They're making an investment in you, and they need to have return.
That's correct. So it have to go with what we know sells.
Whereas in the past. They're investing one editor's time, basically. And they're not investing all of this promotion and everything.
Yeah,
like
but you know what?
Now.
They're not doing as much promotion as you might think.
That's right. That's coming.
No, and that
there was a time, but you're right.
I can give you a story on that one, too.
Please do.
Yeah. That Kevin talked about. an older author, I'm not even going to note sex of them, came to him and said, I'd like to work with you. He thought, oh, this is great. I know this person, you know, been around for years and everything. And then he starts digging into checking them out to see what kind of social presence they have.
Ooh.
Well, this person does no self-promotion socially at all and refuses to do what he found out. Mm-hmm. So guess who he did not bring into the fold?
That's right. Yep. Yeah, that's right. You, all that being said about gatekeepers, you have to be willing to play the game to a certain degree. You have to do that.
Yeah. Unless they think they have really captured lightning in a bottle, brand new authors have to do almost all of their own promotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're taking out Amazon ads or anything like that, but you know, if they want to get on the radio or whatever,
start a podcast,
they've got to arrange all that stuff themselves. They've got to run their own website.
One great example of a recent success that did get the backing and a huge figure is author T.J. Newman, who wrote the book 3 years ago called Falling. About a aircraft that is crashing, and she was a pilot, a flight attendant on Red Eyes, and she wrote this. She's a young lady, and it was a mega seller that summer in 22, I think it was, and she's even released the second one, and this is at a 6-figure advance from one of the majors.
That's almost unheard of for
a brand spanking new author, never before tried. I read about the first 3 chapters, and she opens with a dream, which to me I just cringed at that obvious trope. But she got it. She, whatever reason, somebody believed in her, and it's sold.
How's the second one selling?
Not as well, from what I understand.
I wonder if the time that she put out the first one had something to do with it, with things going on throughout our country.
And that is correct. I think some of this is capturing what lightning in a bottle, as you say, for the times. I did not think she was a bad author by any means. Please don't misunderstand me. But it's kind of like, how did this one get picked? Because to me, it seemed very pedestrian.
But you know what? That's an interesting...
No, please go ahead. And then I got something.
Okay. But that whole idea of a story that is set, a novel, you know, not even just a short story.
Yeah.
But a novel is set with a plane that is crashing, falling out of the sky.
That's right, yeah.
That's a pretty unique take.
You kind of know how it ends.
Well, you kind of know how it ends.
Do you?
But you may not.
You know how part of it will end.
Yeah.
They may pull out at the last second.
No, they don't. And the sequel picks up after the end. And I think it's a one-word title. I think it's like Drowning. Or
no, not everybody dies right off.
That's right. Yeah. So it's
pull
thing.
Out. I'm 12.
Word boner.
Yeah, different kind of word boner.
Skip a bit, brother.
But my
point is, the Imperator's influence isn't always positive.
Never? Never, yeah. But my point is, though, that's such a unique take. I can see why...
they went with it,
Went with it, but also maybe they let things like... Because, you know, one of the things that you'll learn if you take some basic writing lessons or you find online courses, they'll tell you, do not start with a dream. Do not start where the main character wakes up and goes about his day from the very beginning.
That's right.
Things like that. Because they're cliched, they're pedestrian, but the dream, I think, if you do it well, you can get away with, because the dream can drop you right into action.
Well, that's exactly why she did it, because the dream is right in the heart of an action. But
see, there you go. That's why she could do it.
That's right.
But none of anybody else's rules are written in stone for everybody.
That's
exactly right. And the book was very, very successful, but it's kind of, how did this, you know, what did she do that made that happen? And
it sounds like it was the hook, personally.
It was the hook, the luck. She's not a bad writer by any means, but she's one out of millions that attempt to get through that gate, and yet she did. And I'm just saying, it is possible. Martin, you wanted to...
Well, I wanted to cede the start here to Brother Andre, and then I want to have...
Cajun mentioned the importance of self-promotion, and I recently listened to a book on tape that was heavily promoted and sold, and I was very disappointed in the product that was produced. It was Britney Spears' book, The Woman Within Me.
Which supposedly sold gazillions.
Gazillions, and it was poorly, poorly written.
So, excellent promotion, not so excellent product.
But you know what?
Even though it had a ghostwriter, I'm sure it did.
I think there was someone to help her. And
that's essentially what
that is.
But
here's the problem. If there was a professional writer associated with it, they should be fired.
Yeah.
Probably a friend or somebody.
Why should they be fired? It sold a million copies. Yeah. So
therein lies the question. It depends on what your value system is.
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. You know, I've seen some horrible crap published by the Big Five. Stuff that is just like...
This would fall in that category.
Yeah, it's sold.
Martin.
So, when you discuss, you know, a new author working on promotion and how to not outflank the gatekeepers, but to bootstrap into the gatekeepers, there's apparently a big scandal that an author who had a contract and a book coming out was going on, like, social media and slamming rivals.
Ooh, bad play.
I remember hearing something about
this. So she was hitting these, you know, these rival books in her genre, and
she was review bombing them?
Yes.
That's it.
Review bombing. And then promoting what she had coming out anonymously.
Yes.
Under the same like
creating
username.
Fake accounts and leaving a song of reviews. Yeah.
Yes. So, and of course, the genre is all tied into, trans stuff and
LGBTQ++.
But the other authors that were getting these horrible reviews began putting this together.
Right. Oh, yeah. Sooner or later, somebody always figures it out.
It's like, oh, these same accounts are putting these same reviews, negative ones on these books and positive on this one author's.
Yes.
And they figured it out and went to the publisher, and the publisher pulled the deal.
That's right.
Pulled the deal, and the book isn't coming out, and it's a big scandal. And, of course, the author is like, well, you know, I'm going into rehab and... I apologize. And
that's almost like a get out of jail free.
Yeah, so it was like wow. But it shows now that, again, this idea that you're talking about, you got to promote yourself. This is how active you've got to be. You know, put your stuff out there.
There is much truth to the fact, like you were saying, Cajun. Do you have to live on social media? Some say yes, some say no. Do you have to have a presence on social media? Absolutely. You cannot do this without.
There's a difference between promotion and denigration of others.
Absolutely. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are ways to do that in many ways that I'll give you one lady that I really admire. She's an independent publisher. Her name is Arabella Federico. She has published two books under her own publishing imprint. They are, what I forget what she calls it, it's a cross between Sailor Moon and space fantasy. Totally not in my genre, but I ended up coming across her on Instagram. She's out of Seattle, and she's a young lady.
Own genre.
She could not get published, so she created her own imprint to do so, and she's published her first two, and she is on it literally every freaking day. But she does it well. She puts herself out there. She grafts herself into the promotion. And I did a little research on her publishing company that she created, and basically the intention was to take down the gatekeepers in the publishing industry. She states this right on their website, which just kind of tells me that they're not thinking beyond that narrow stream.
No, and they never have.
And they never have, but it's really narrow now because nobody would even take a chance on her. And I've read synopses of her. I mean, yeah, it's a very niche market. It's a very niche genre, but... why can't it have its space, especially if you do it well? And she has. The third book is getting ready to come out.
And that was the whole point of self-publishing.
That's essentially
what she...
find a place
and meet others and provide a product.
Essentially what she did, and she must do this full-time because literally she's on there every single day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
it's successful.
A lot of the stuff that should be done, you have to almost have to have no other job.
And she does it. I mean, I will give her credit for the quality that she does. I don't know what her sales are like or any of that sort of stuff. And of course, it's on Amazon. It's on, you know, Barnes & Noble, the whole schmear. And again, it's not my genre, so I'm not going to read it. But I probably will purchase it just to support her at some point.
Well,
on that note, I want my favorite time of profession to come along on a 24-hour basis.
Bourbon break. Yeah, you had to stop us because we will keep going.
Oh, yes, I know. Yes, I know.
Well, writing is probably the one subject that we could totally skip over Bourbon Break without realizing it.
That's right.
Yes, it's true. We've got a very unique bourbon for this one. And who wants to say the name of it? Oh, I'll do it then. Cock of the Walk. Mm-hmm. Yes, boo me for that one. No, this is a private label bottled privately. From one of the local farms around here. It's very unique that it has corn in it that probably came from the ranch out here a few years back.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Cajun's very own bourbon seeds.
That's right. So it's very unique. I personally am enjoying it.
Very much so.
Oh, I think it's killer.
It's got a lovely killer. Amber color. Well,
Imperator, what's your sniffer there say?
Very fruity, citrusy kind of off of it. I don't know if it was up to me based off of. Yeah, it would be something that would overly appeal to me. It reminds me of some of the more citrusy drinks.
Interesting.
It almost comes off to me as like it's pre-mixed with like a pineapple juice or something. It's really
interesting.
Well, I said we have a little story about this distillery.
Uh-huh. Yeah, please.
This lady out of California come in, says, "With plenty and plenty and plenty of money." I have no idea where it all came from, but she started buying up barrels and barrels and barrels of bourbon back when we had the slump.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
And she's been sitting on them for years. She's bought old brand names such as Waddy Boone, which comes out of this distillery.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Cock of the Walk was an original thing. And these are blended. Mm-hmm. A lot of these older whiskeys with newer corn that's distilled too.
Okay, all right.
In fact, somebody told me recently that she's been sitting on a lot of barrels of Pappy that didn't sell very well back when we had the slump years ago. That's going into some of these.
A very wise woman, it seems. Yes.
She's blending Pappy.
Yeah.
Like I say, I was told that. I don't know if it's true or not.
It's Preservation Distillery, correct?
I believe so.
That's right, which puts out the Waddy Boone brand, which we have sampled. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at it up here on your shelf, Cajun. I have a bottle that you gifted me that it's named after an ancestor of mine again. But it's
surely not.
Surely not.
How can that possibly be? Yeah.
But this one here is very different from that. That one has a stronger bite, if I recall correctly. This is very, very smooth.
The Waddy's stronger. I think it's more reminiscent of the time the original came out.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
You know, maybe age didn't age as long. It had more of a bite to it.
Yeah, I remember.
But now, here's the thing. Who wants to take a guess at what proof this is if you haven't looked?
I looked. It's like 112, 114.
Look at it. He ruins the game.
Yeah, no. I was going to say, but
I would not have guessed 112 off the top of my head.
No, I'm sitting here. Now, I've let it bloom, but you know, this is a smooth, kissing bourbon.
I mean, I tried it before it even started melting.
Yeah. Well, you know, before the ice started melting, I would have guessed a higher proof.
Yes.
I don't think I would have guessed 100, 102 or so.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I might have gone a little higher, but it definitely. You could tell it was a much higher proof than the first two that we had done today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because it still retains a bit of its spark, it's a bit of its oomph, a bit of its push.
But, you know, once it's bloomed, it definitely does not taste like a 112 proof.
So, I mean, it's very similar in proof to the old Grandad 114 that we've had.
Yes.
But I think a ton smoother.
Yes.
More flavor.
Very much so.
Okay, on this is much more complex.
This is killer stuff. I love this sort of apple pie flavor it almost has.
Good. Yeah.
Baked apple.
There's a sweetness to
baked
it.
Baked apple cobbler sweetness to it.
It's not a peppery thing at all.
No. But it's not overpoweringly sweet.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little bit balanced.
It's not cool.
With a touch of pepper to it. But very, very balanced, nice and complex, a little bit oaky, mature, flavor to it, and I think it's killer.
If you take 10 sips of this bourbon, you'll get 8 different flavors that are pronounced. It has so many different layers of complexity, and maybe that's from all the blending that happened.
Well, yeah, that's a very good theory.
I don't know how much blending happened in this particular bottle. I do know there's a lot of blending that goes on over there.
Yeah, we passed by them on the way out here. Robert and Andre.
Very small.
I don't think I pointed them out. It was right at the Bluegrass Parkway.
I mean, they brew a batch. You're probably looking at 4 to 5 barrels in a batch when they make over there.
Okay. Yeah. Blending used to be the main thing, as I understand it, but with the craft stuff going on.
It kind of got a dirty connotation for a while, but it's come back.
Well, and, you know, Bardstown Bourbon, they're almost entirely.
That's right. And you just need a few folks that do it very well. And that respect the process, and Bardstown Bourbon Herbie is very good at that, yes.
And, you know, one of the things that...
Her Majesty toured there just a few weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, you know, one of the things
I did not too long back, too, last year.
Yeah, she was very, very pleased, yes.
Yeah, I think if you're blending, you're probably going to get a more consistent bourbon because you can alter your mix to get the profile.
Yeah, if you know what you're doing and you're very deliberate.
Yeah, you know, from batch to batch. And mm-hmm. I don't know that... You know, all the ones that we have called comfort bourbons are necessarily blended, but I like the consistency of certain bourbons from bottle to bottle so that I know when I pick up a bottle of 1792 small batch, it's going to be the same as the last bottle or the bottle of
Woodford. That's what most bourbon distillers are looking for. But within some of them like a little bit of variance.
Yes. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. But you can still tell, this is Booker's, mm-hmm. this is Old Forester.
And you realize that when they bring down the Woodford or the Four Roses or whatever, those are blended barrels, Yellowstone. They're blended from the same warehouse from different barrels at different levels to achieve a continuation of their taste that you associate with.
You have to. Otherwise, if you're using a single barrel for your bottling, they'll all be different, you know.
Some distillers like that. And almost all the big names have some kind of single barrel program that they are running.
That's right.
Because, for one thing, you can charge more for it.
The term single barrel became niche where it was interpreted as being better than a blended, which is... But I think a blended is a more uniform product.
Yeah, that's and
it so can
you,
be.
You
yeah.
get both. Yeah, yeah, neither is a dirty word. No matter, although I'm sure there are snobs on both sides that will say, "Hey man, only this one is a proper one."
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've heard some people denigrate the idea of blending, but I think that's
that's silly
hogwash.
Silly. As long as it's all bourbon, it's hard to go bad. We know it can happen.
But it is the exception, not the rule.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So basically, the biggest thing, keep it out of the sunlight.
Yeah, that's true.
Direct sunlight, I'll hurt it faster than anything.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Give us the name of this one again.
Cock of the Walk, mate. Without
cock
the mate.
Cock of the Walk.
That's right.
Cock of the walk.
Yeah, that's right.
I thought I'd put a little English spin on it.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely killer and tremendous. So.
Yeah. I kind of wish I had just put water in it rather than the ice. It was. I think it had a better flavor when it was warmer.
Yeah, when it's closer to it, really.
It does not give it that real heavy, high-proof flavor at all.
No, it definitely...
Well, when it was neat, I asked if it was a rye on my initial taste because it was higher.
There does feel like there's a little bit of peppery taste at the beginning.
Like I said, I can't tell you what the mash bill on it. It was a private selection.
Mm-hmm. And we are grateful that we are able to partake. Yes, indeed.
Yes.
So there's no way to look it up or see. This is actually a single barrel.
Yeah, it even gives the barrel number.
Barrel number 2.
Yeah, that's right. We are honored to be able
to. So this one is not a blend. I can't answer that question.
Yeah.
Well, then it sat in the barrel for a long time because there's some complexity of flavor.
Amen to that, yes.
Well, you know, we've discovered that's not even necessarily the case.
No.
A lot of distillers.
Environment.
Yeah, a lot of distillers have come up with ways to simulate the aging process by moving it on the river, you know, back and forth a short distance, helps the bourbon slosh in the barrel.
Sloshing.
Turning the barrels, the temperature, the rickhouse.
Right, playing music.
Vibration.
A heavy
playing
bass.
Music.
Vibration. Playing a heavy bass.
The sound vibrations. Sound vibrations will force the things to shake. And, it's amazing.
Technology has caught up with the bourbon.
Yeah, the science that is here
in and out
is,
of the wood. In that's and right. out
well,
of the
I mean,
you're
well,
doing what
have,
there, boy?
I wasn't going to say
what,
it, but I did think it.
One of the things that I think is going to change rapidly, and it's already being adapted in the wine industry, and I sent you all an article on it, is the stainless steel barrels where you put the staves inside of it. So you're getting more surface area. You're getting more consistency. You can mix barrel types within your stuff.
But you're not getting the flame part of the barrel.
Yeah,
you are. It's already charred.
You char the staves. Char the outside of the staves, too.
Yes.
You charge all dimensions of it. Oh, okay. So,
because
you would then get more surface. You can control
how much.
Yeah.
Of what type? You could mix a cherry with an oak with an apple.
Well, that breaks the legal definition of bourbon, so I don't know that you'll be. You might see that in a secondary barreling, but you'd have to change the definition.
No, I mean, you don't have. I mean, you don't. It wouldn't necessarily be a bourbon.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
But yeah.
It's a whiskey.
They're doing this with wine to allow more consistency and more scientific control over what's going on with the aging process.
The purist in me cringes at the word stainless steel barrel.
No, I mean, the way they've done this, it's actually scientifically very...
Well, let's look at it this way. If it becomes successful enough, it gathers money and power, somebody will change the definition by law.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which oft our stage has shown.
So back to Superstars writing symposium event thingy.
All right. Well, I mentioned a minute ago David Weber and talking about legacy planning, and one of the best ways too was set up an S corp when you get started. But let's hit a few highlights since all of us are at various stages and so forth and have intellectual properties now, basically. I'm just going to hit some high notes and we can kind of discuss it. He now says, of course, know what you have produced and protect it, of course. This is the best way to look at it.
Okay.
Who can be the curator for what you have been produced? Who can produce new content, which he has, Hollow and Pope, I believe he's been working with some. You recognize those two names?
Pope, I think. I don't know about the other one.
I think Pope, continue his Honorverse series. Be very clear on who has authority for direction of the books. Mm. Not just who has the clearance to write, but who has the authority to direct what the direction should be, which is not always the same person.
Right, right. It needs to be the equivalent of a showrunner.
Right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Of course, be trademarked when you publish so that it is your legal property. Mm-hmm. Let your feelings be known and document it. Document any feelings you have about your property for future uses such as media, as in Frank Herbert's Dune, being produced for TV, movies, what have you. I like this one too. And this is more of a process thing, not necessarily a legacy thing. And I love this point. Never ever get to the point where you don't listen to your editor.
What'd you say?
Yes.
You never get to the point where you don't listen to
He was trying to be cute.
Yeah, absolutely. A great editor is gold.
I mean, kind of a partner in
that's right.
Exactly.
And an editor usually is a function of your publisher. But essentially, I mean, sometimes it may be a team, it may be whatever.
Well, and let's differentiate. You've got multiple kinds of editors.
Oh, yes.
That's correct.
You know, essentially, I think what he's referring to is more the developmental editor. Because your copy editor, you know, that's it. Well, first of all, if you don't listen to the copy editor,
you're dumb.
That's really stupid.
That's right.
Capitalize the first letter of every sentence, et cetera, et cetera.
Listen
et cetera.
To all your editors.
Yes, listen to all of them.
If you have a problem working with that editor, then find one you can work with.
Right. And not just one that's going to be, you know, a kiss your ass kind of.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Somebody that'll push you, make you better, so forth.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, the trust level is essential. No question as you do that.
You got to have somebody that will challenge your assumptions and your decisions without being offensive.
Right, you know? And that falls into his next statement. Every storyteller needs a sounding board.
Yep.
Not necessarily your editor to bounce ideas off and toss it back and forth.
Well, absolutely.
We all look at each other.
I say we have the brotherhood.
We have a brotherhood here that has done that I mean, literally, we just did it last night. That's right, because yeah. I had a technical question that I posed to the guys. And
yes, and as I was complaining to Brother Andre and Francis outside a few minutes ago before we started this one, I was really getting pissed off at these guys because I was trying to work on my own book and my phone was blowing up with message after message
The question, I was stunned. Every one of you guys came in with lots of helpful stuff. Mm-hmm. It really is. I mean, it was just a logistics question. It's about a firearm, about wounds and things like that. And you guys jumped on that like a duck on a June bug, as they used to say out here.
Yeah.
And solved the problem very quickly with lots of input from lots of places.
Yeah, you kicked around a lot of options.
That's correct. We didn't just solve the problem. We gave you various options. We were looking at different ways you could go with it.
Investigated and pummeled that expired equine until we finally came out with the right answer. And I'll give the Imperator credit for the actual final way of doing it, because he himself experienced a wounding via a firearm. So that put him right to the top of the list.
Wasn't his first, I'm sure.
He was able to cut through it with personal experience.
And amazingly enough, it wasn't like an aggravated husband shooting at him or anything.
No. That's true.
Or
his own wife.
I was going to say his wife would be the first one because she
didn't get it. Yeah. Gluteus Maximus climbing out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. An aggrieved husband would have to stand in line, wouldn't he?
It was a self-inflicted, but.
Ricochet. It was a ricochet.
That still counts as self-inflicted.
That's right. Continue,
Katie. Okay. Well, we kind of said this, but need to think about planning early, no matter when you're starting, and that your intent is known, it repeats. Nice comment here to think about. Most major literary universes die with the passing of the author.
Mm-hmm. I would understand that.
Prepare. Story is secondary. Make sure whoever you choose to keep it going can do your voice.
Oh, yeah. I'll give you a great example of this, too, and you know this. Edward S. Ahrens, who wrote the Assignment series from, like, 55 until he passed away in, like, 86, 20 years of, like, almost over 40 books that sold gazillions, 20 million copies for the whole series for Fawcett Books. And they were excellent. I mean, you've read the whole series. He passes away, and because these things still sell so well, they picked up a ghostwriter and named it after the guy's brother to continue. But they ran four and stopped because it just didn't have it. It's because and those later books that they tried to make that work with, some of it the trends were changing and things like that. It's just the gatekeeper, the guy who created it. Only he knows that character so well, and anything else was noticeably just not there.
Yeah, I would argue that the story and characters will die with the author. You can get someone to write in your voice and continue the story, but any attuned reader will know the difference.
That's right.
I remember what comes to mind is Rex Stout in.
Yes.
His character
Nero Wolfe. Yeah,
it was continued in the 90s and up to now by an author by the name of Robert Goldsboro.
Yeah,
and it's still a wonderful story in the same genre, but you can definitely tell what was written by
there
Rex
was
Stout.
There was only one Stout. That's right. He's one of the perfect examples too of you can't go home again. Ian Fleming. Goodness knows that John Gardner did a spectacular job in the 80s of continuing the character, but it was not Fleming. It was not. He wrote about, I think, 11 books of James Bond, and they were good. But I remember buying the first one thinking, wow, this is new. And it was good, but it was not Fleming.
No.
And it's just...
But there's the thing. Don't knock perfection for good enough and sit on it forever. Oh, yeah. It was a good story. He wrote a good story. No, it wasn't Fleming, but it continued.
Oh, yeah.
Character,
it sold well.
New adventures.
I have the whole series. It's sold very, very well.
Even the same author, because authors change,
right,
can write. Now, granted, usually this takes where you have a lot of time in between books, but the same author can write in a series. And when you get to the end, it feels like it's an entirely different person than it was when it started.
Is it because the author's changed or the character's changed?
Well, it can
be because their outlook on things have changed. It can be age. It can be all kinds of things. I use Isaac Asimov's Foundation series as the prime example of this.
Yeah,
he wrote the first three, in the 50s into the early 60s, And then when he finally revisited them starting in the 80s, everything he wrote seemed like a betrayal of his own philosophy that he stated in, you know, personally as well as in the books.
Yeah, which was just one of the foundational, no pun intended, pieces that made those things popular.
Right. And it was just, it just seems so out of left field. And so, you know, you can have that where it's, this doesn't feel like it should be.
Because he returned to it so much later at a different
place.
And
that's part of it.
Aaron's was similar with his series, too. By the time you read the last one, he had gotten very formulaic, only because, and I am doing a little research on this, Fawcett told him, you need to do it this way because these sell. So lean into this, lean into this, lean into this. He was granted less freedom, but, you know, they're paying him guzu money because, you know, these things are selling. They're 20 million copies.
A perfect example of continuation and stuff going wrong would be Douglas Adams.
Oh, yes.
The Hitchhiker's Guide series. You had three wonderful books. Then the publisher pushed and pushed and pushed for a fourth. His heart wasn't in it. You ended up with Mostly Harmless, which was, to be fair, a horrible book compared to the others.
Yeah.
And then once he passed, his wife came back, got another writer, wanted to go on with it.
Yeah.
And God, that went into the tank.
Well, there was only one master. Adams was, you know, well known as being that good. Yeah.
He was, but only for what he had his heart in.
That's true. Some of his Doctor Who stuff, the early stuff he did was fantastic.
Yeah,
and as he eventually got, you know, he and the BBC went to loggerheads, some of his later stuff was just didn't have it. His heart was out of it.
Yeah, but part of the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, one of the things you're going to see happening more and more is, as you've got these prolific authors, you're going to end up with, they're going to train the AI on what they've done before.
Oh, God.
And you're going to get their voice.
Which could be good, could be bad.
Could be good, could be bad. I'm just not saying.
And the law has not even
begun
to catch up with that sort of thing.
It's going
to
start.
So, well, yeah, you know, one of the things that, you know, to your point about Adams, about the same author within a relatively short time frame.
Oh, yeah, no, it was
right
in there.
Can change the mm-hmm. tenor of the story. Mm-hmm. Part of that, I think, is the difference in storytelling. So Fleming, with his just ungodly number of books, along with the Mac Bolans and all those were a very specific genre of books that were... They were a series, but they're not a series in the way we tend to think of them mm-hmm. today.
Oh, you're exactly right. By the time Fleming wrote Goldfinger, which was in 59, he'd done like six books. That, in my opinion, was his last original book. Everything else...
There's that, too.
Yeah, because by that time, he's writing for the market.
Yes,
and
well,
he's running out of
ideas.
Yeah,
and he's got
a formula.
Yeah,
he's got to hit that. And a lot of his originality went away. Thunderball had some of that, which was in 61. Mm-hmm. For Your Eyes Only was in 60. It had a collection of stories he had on the shelf. 61 was Thunderball was about, he co-wrote that to try and reinvigorate the character. But after that, it's kind of like, well, what do we want to do now? It's almost like he's drunk and he's sitting there writing, well, let's try this.
Like, Frank Herbert, why do you keep writing those books? Because they keep paying me.
The Spy Who Loved Me was absolutely, completely against type. It was a very experimental book. It's nothing like the movie. And it's only because he'd sold the others that they let him do it, because it should not have ever gotten published.
And that
it was
kind of
so different.
That kind of genre is, even though it's a series, they're standalones.
Yes.
There's very little. All right, character starts here and ends up way
James
over
Bond
here.
Never changes.
James
I mean,
Bond
that's actually become
changes.
A trope.
It's always a status quo ante at the end of it.
That's
exactly
right.
Well, a lot of the same kind of. I think Francis, you've said that they called that genre at the time. It doesn't exist as a separate genre anymore. Yeah. Men's adventure.
Men's adventure. It began there, but it really Mac Bolan really started that in '69. And through the 60s, the 70s and 80s, it was huge. And then
the
90s,
but again,
it peters out.
You know, they're standalone. You can pick up any one of those books,
and
you
most
don't have
of them
to read any of the others.
Most of
most
them are ghostwritten. That's a guy. The guys are making money, and some of these guys are very good.
Sure.
Many of them ain't worth squat, but you know these guys are making livings. You know,
but they turn them out. And
absolutely.
Buy. Yeah. Nowadays, when people talk about a series, it's much more like the David Weber series.
That's right. Yeah, a
where
true
it is
series.
One character.
Yep.
And their ancillary characters, their cast, their background
their posse.
Characters, their loves, their parents, whatever. and takes them from a point in time until death.
You're exactly right.
Or until whatever part of the story that is the point is resolved.
Edward S. Ahrens was an anomaly during that time because he wrote the same character himself. John D. MacDonald, same thing with Travis McGee. He started the same thing, and he carries it all the way through his end. And lets the character grow. Even though each book's a standalone, he's not afraid to do any of that. Those were the exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the times, you don't get that. But there's a reason those books have continued to enjoy either still being read or at least respected.
Well, and I think that's the difference between those standalone series, even though it's an oxymoron.
Yeah.
But for those standalone series and something like a Weber or Eric Flint's 1632 or the books you're writing, the stories that I'm telling, we view them differently as like there's a story.
Oh, yeah. There is a...
And we're just telling...
A meta arc.
We're telling an episode in the life of the character. And
it's more of a serial.
It's a serial, I think it's intended to be a little bit more sophisticated.
Oh yeah, well Jack Aubrey is the perfect example of that. Patrick O'Brien, who started writing Master and Commander in like 68.
Well, Sharps.
Sharps, absolutely. Bernard Cornwell has done the same thing. He's carried that character through history.
Exactly.
And of course there, both of those characters are tied specifically to history, but Sharp does not change a whole lot. He does. He does grow, but Aubrey Stephen Maturin absolutely change from the beginning to the end, and that's really the whole. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons those books are still just idolized by so many folks is because they are called the Aubreyed. It's one story, and O'Brien did that deliberately to show the lives of these two characters and sold gazillion copies. He's one that does it well,
and you know it lends itself to television.
Well, very
and
much
to
so.
Movies.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so you know tying all that kind of stuff together. Obviously, the goal of it's the ironic goal of most authors today is not to sell a million books.
To get picked up by Netflix.
It's to get picked up by Netflix.
That's right. We hear that all the time.
Changing technology and media out that way, makes you money, and it's going to change going forward.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, having that more sophisticated than a standalone series, as I called it, you're more likely to do that. And I think that's what readers have come to expect.
I mean, what's the next phase? Immersion with the goggles and so forth, where you're in the story?
Virtual reality of some sort, yeah.
You
remember we were talking with Tony from Hydra Press Imaginarium, and he was very clear to me, and I suspect he was to you all because we were at different points. He says series is where it's at.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely, that's where if you want to be a successful writer, series is where you'll, by the time you've written four books, you might start to actually see a little bit of money.
Back catalog.
It's really what it's about.
Success.
And that takes time, but it also takes sustainability in your creation of your characters. I get that. But it also takes a lot of persistence.
It does.
Stick with it.
The series is even true on the nonfiction side of things.
Very much so. Yes,
you
right.
Know, if you're going to write multiple nonfiction books, it's better to have a theme that permeates all of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dan Jones is a great one for doing that because he's writing history, English history. But, you know, and we are big fans of him. He's written several all over the place, but now he's gotten to the point where he's known. When you see his name, Dan Jones, you know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And it's in some very good stuff that he's done.
Yeah, well, very, very readable English history.
Yeah, Tom Holland, as you, really one of good. Your favorites, is very much about that, yeah.
David McCullough.
Yeah. Very much so, yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's one of the grandfathers of that,
McCullough, his 1776, I think, is one of the best books on history that you will ever read because it is so accessible.
And McCullough is just good. He's just that talented, too.
Even the boy who had to read that for a class really liked that. And he's generally not big into... history, unfortunately. It's one of my failings as a parent.
Well, we do the best we can. But you should speak of your boy because you have accolades to give him.
So, yes. So I may have failed him in some ways. I did write by him at others. For instance, I
at least
asked,
genetically.
Genetically, yes. I once asked him what the best all-around album was, and his answer...
Police Synchronicity?
Absolutely.
Of course it was.
No hesitation. Yes. So that warmed the cockles of my fatherly heart. But as far as the other accolades, so the boy, as I like to call him, has applied to many different schools. And, you know, he's pretty much could go anywhere he wanted. The only school he did not get into, he got a provisional acceptance, or not a provisional acceptance, but a delayed, a deferred, a deferment. That's what they call it.
Yeah.
Because he applied to MIT. It's like, we're full up on this round. You know, after we decide, after people decide, okay, I'm going to go here, who's not going to go here, slots will open up. You're free to, we'll take a look at you again in the fall, or in the spring, I mean. But everywhere else, he's been accepted. Now, at Bellarmine, which is our alma mater, everybody except for Andre. Brother Andre, I don't know how we let this guy in, but
he's just a good hilltopper.
Oh, boy.
It's from the state. It's from the state.
Yeah, it's from the state. But anyways, they had a they have a competition every year for their honors program. It used to be called Cardinal Section.
Yeah, as we remember.
Many moons ago, yeah.
Many moons ago. It's now just called their honors program. Yeah. And there were 136 people who from all over the country that competed this year. And the prizes were the top five got a all tuition room and board scholarship. So basically you pay nothing except your matriculation fee to get in and to go to school. The next five got a full tuition scholarship. If they want to pay, you know, live on campus, they have to pay room and board themselves. The boy got one of the top five.
Congratulations, sir.
Congratulations.
So, I mean, it is the, he is the, literally, this is the cream of the cream of the crop. It's, I mean, they basically wrote him nearly $250,000 check to go to Bellarmine for 4 years. Not quite that, but pretty darn close.
And the good news is you don't have to.
And I don't have to. when my last payment to DeSales goes out in May, I immediately get a huge raise the following month. Because
Yes, I did the very same. That's
yes, it is glorious.
Yes, when my young one, Indiana, went to EKU, it was amazing the amount of money that I got back.
Yes, but yes, great accolades to him, and he is really bought into Bellarmine. I mean, he is all in.
He better.
I was going to say, after all we've talked about all this time, yeah, come on. Yeah,
Swords up.
That's right.
But, I mean, he's bought into it, and I mean, he's not a terribly social kid, like many his age. You know, he sits there and he plays video games online with his friends, and that's his social interaction. You know, so it's kind of social. Sad. So that he's not sad. I'm just quoting Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
So there's some kind of Bellarmine event that is next weekend, I think it is. No, it's this weekend. And he was like, oh, I wasn't planning on going because I thought we were doing, you know, one of the family Easter events. But that family has COVID passing around, so they're putting it off.
Good idea, Lord.
You know, he actually wants to go. And they have all kinds of swag they send out, and he's wearing that stuff all the time. And I'm telling you, it makes me so happy.
Warms the heart, eh?
It does. Mm-hmm. It does. Anyways, that's three of us at Bellarmine.
Awesome.
To two at U of L. So Boo wins.
You just loved saying that, didn't you? Good thing your wife doesn't listen.
Well, she knows. Yeah, she knows.
I was going to say, I'm sure you've told her this.
Speaking of U of L, the eldest daughter, she will finally finish up she's finishing up her last class at U of L right now, and she will finally get her degree from U of L this fall, or this spring, I mean.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So she,
great.
Awesome. Her, didn't have to pay much for her either, for the U of L, which is fine. Glad to hear that, you know. Didn't have to pay everything for Samantha, for middle child's education, but some.
All is well.
But, you know, my children have all done quite well. I'm quite proud of all of them.
Excellent. So, Cajun.
Congratulations.
Bring us back.
All right. Well, that pretty much wraps up that. And I don't really have the time, I don't think, to get into Jim Butcher and what he said. I think I'll save that for another time around.
You could maybe post that on the blog, perhaps.
That's possible. Yeah, might get around to that.
Good idea, Lord.
Don't hold your breath, though. You know me and writing on the blog.
Yeah.
But, I think we're getting kind of close to wrapping this one up, ain't we?
We are, but the Hoopajibs, we generally allow a little bit longer. How are you doing on time there, Martin?
I'm already in the doghouse, way over.
Well,
we should. Let us bring it home.
That's why I thought I'd
we could finish it and I can scoot, that'd be awesome.
All right.
Anybody else have any announcements on there?
Mrs. Martin's birthday, so.
Yes, happy birthday, Mrs. Martin.
Amen. Yes, exactly. As we record.
Yes. Since that's the case, I was just going to say that I love these particular episodes because it's a micro moment of these events that you went to, Cajun.
Oh, and sitting coming around. Up next month, I'll be at JordanCon in Atlanta, actually, when you fellows are recording, and hopefully I'll be able to call in like I did with Colorado.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to hit a lot of these different events here.
Yes, which we are greatly pleased that you do. There, not that, just that you have the ability.
Do a little
but
recon
can,
work for us all. Yes,
yeah, eyes and
that
ears.
You share the intelligence there.
Next year, we definitely need to keep an eye on Indiana Comic-Con. They had a buttload of great guests up there this time around.
Yeah, I think there's actually something going on that particular weekend. We probably couldn't have gone anyways, but it is one that is being so close. We should keep an eye on. Amen. But I just love the fact that we can all sit around talking about this stuff because this is one of the best things about those conventions is to sit around and talk with
others.
It's
the networking, absolutely.
About, well, not even just the networking, but just hearing other people talk about what you love.
Oh yeah, when I say networking, it sounds rather business oriented. It's not that. It's that human camaraderie, like you're talking about here. That sharing of craft. You know, it's art, not science.
All right. Well, let's wrap this one up and put it in the books. What we got coming up next?
We're going to go back to history next time. You know, we're doing this loose series these days about westward expansion, Manifest Destiny, and all that. We're going to talk a lot about one of the big issues on that, the Indian Wars that took place after the Civil War, the pacification, and that is a loose term, of the American West and the atrocities, dare I say, that were committed against the Native American tribes out there. We're going to go deep with all the history and the morality, or lack thereof, in all of that. So be here next episode.
We hope you enjoyed another pointless discussion of eternal questions. Remember, new episodes drop every second and fourth Friday at 6 a.m. Eastern, just in time for your morning commute. And every fifth Friday, we drop a special Hoopajube episode. Spread the word, we are on all the major platforms, and leave us a review. That helps others find us. We're also on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, as well as our website, snakesandotters.com. Join us next time, same snake time, same otter channel.